The Brad Sessmatt Show, broadcasting live from the Skyview Network Studios.
Howdy do, one and all. It is Thursday. Brad is off today. I'm Jeff Munn, Arizona State Women's Basketball, Phoenix Rising FC. Any place I can go and work, that's where I work. And by golly, that includes here. On a Thursday, and we're delighted to have you with us, sports360.com, azcentralsports.com, AZ Central, of course, partners with Sports 360 to bring you this program on a daily basis, and we're glad that you're tuned in on this Thursday. Lots to get to today. Tim Kempton, Suns radio analyst, will be with us to discuss the hiring of Igor Kokoskov as the new head coach, the direction of the franchise. The draft lottery is next week. Somebody put out on social media, pardon me here, I've got a little itch in my eye, live programming. Somebody tweeted out yesterday that the lottery was last night. I was like, huh? No, it's Tuesday of next week during what I would assume to be the Eastern Conference Finals. In any event, we'll discuss that. We'll get his thoughts about the playoffs and the upcoming draft. Who looks the best to him, without regard for the Suns' draft position, just who are the best players in his mind that are going to be available to the Suns in the draft lottery? It's Thursday. We'll visit with AZ Central and Gannett Chief Film Media Critic Bill Gutekunst. Three really different types of movies this week. Revenge, Life of the Party, and Measure of a Man. And just, you want to talk about going all kinds of different directions with films this weekend. We're really spanning the spectrum, so to speak. Or what is it that Lee Hamilton used to say? We're covering the waterfront in movies. If you check out Brad's Sports Media podcast, you know who Lee Hamilton is. In any event, lots to get to. We want to get right into the news of the day. And what's going on in the world of sports is brought to you by Sagicor Now. They're great partners with those of us here at Sports 360. And Brad talks about this a great deal on the show, about if you have not thought in the past about life insurance, now is the optimum time to do that. And I'm getting to an age where I'm really glad I made the decisions I made years and years ago. Well, if you're that young age and you have a young family, this is the time to be thinking about how to take care of them if something unfortunate happens. The people at Sagicor Now will be more than happy to sit with you, discuss options. They do it in a way that is very comfortable for you to process, and you make your own decisions. So check out Sagicor Now. They'll be happy to help you plan for your future. And as I've always said, it's peace of mind for you and your family. D-backs lost last night in Los Angeles to the Dodgers. Kind of an unusual game, 6-3. Patrick Corbin, some issues with command, four walks over six innings, had to be pulled in the sixth. He was at 96 pitches, so not really a lot of problem. And he came out with the bases loaded, and the Dodgers scored three in the inning. And I'm trying to remember, let me get right to the box score here, and I can tell you that they went to Fernando Salas, who gave up three runs, three hits, over two-thirds of an inning to close out the sixth, or try to close out the sixth. Andrew Chafin walked a man in that inning, and then Silvino Bracho finished out the inning. But by then, the damage had been done. Alex Wood, not much better in terms of just getting deep in the game. He went five innings, a run, five hits, three walks, four strikeouts. So the D-backs get a split with the Dodgers in L.A. Now they come home. They have four with the Washington Nationals this weekend. A game one, obviously, tonight at Chase Field. And Chase Field has been in the news quite a bit lately. And obviously, the county board of supervisors gave their final approval yesterday to the agreement that allows the D-backs to essentially leave Chase Field after the 2022 season. They will take over control of the ballpark in the off-season months, which means they'll be the ones responsible for booking anything and everything that comes into the ballpark in the off-season months. And obviously, this fuels the speculation that the D-backs will leave downtown Phoenix as soon as they are legally allowed to do so and move elsewhere. Now, let me take this from a couple of different angles very quickly. I know Brad has talked about on the show many times about how the East Valley is really the ideal place for teams to locate because that's where the population base is. And up until recently, I would have said, no, I don't agree with that. You know, you need to be downtown. All the traffic arteries go downtown. Light rail goes downtown. businesses, retail is downtown. And I was in the camp that said, no, you don't leave downtown. But I will say this, as I've mentioned, I have the grand honor of being the stadium announcer for Phoenix Rising FC. And I know many of you have been out to their stadium at the 101 and the 202. And it's been a tremendous success story. They drew 7,300 fans last Friday night, a legitimate 7,300. And that location in the East Valley, where there's a lot of families, a lot of soccer families, you think to yourself, would that team be as successful if that stadium was somewhere else? Now, remember when Kyle Engel owned that franchise, and it was a different league and a different name, they played at the Peoria Sports Complex. They were not doing crowds like that. And so I think to myself, okay, there's a validity to Brad's argument that the East Valley is where you need to go. There is some sadness on my part because, obviously, I was with the Diamondbacks. I was there the night they broke ground. I did some of the announcing at the groundbreaking ceremony that Joe Garagiola Sr. emceed. And so there's a lot of personal investment in the place. But I understand times change, people move on. I think the D-backs have been very fond or big fans of what Atlanta has done with their new stadium out in the Buckhead area of Atlanta, moving out of downtown or south of downtown in Turner Field to SunTrust Park. And I think they look at that as a prototype of what they want to do moving forward. I can't blame them for that. I would love to see them stay downtown. I'd love to see them stay at Chase Field and fix whatever's wrong. But they feel like their future's in the East Valley, and I guess time will show us where exactly they're headed. One other quick thought. I heard an idea the other day, and Eric Sorensen is with us this morning, as always. And if you want to jump in on this, you certainly can.
Hello, Mon.
On the famous eCam.
There I am.
There he is. I heard an idea from somebody in another form of local media who said, if the D-backs leave Chase Field, what Maricopa County ought to do is obviously bulldoze the building, but then turn around or start negotiations soon with the Suns and the Coyotes to put a multi-purpose arena on that land, that piece of land at 7th Street and Jefferson.
Makes sense.
I think it does make sense because you have enough room there. We always used to say in the materials that we would put out to the media about Chase Field that you could put 10 arenas, what was then America West Arena, you could put 10 of those in Chase Field.
Mm-hmm.
Translation, there's plenty of room to build an arena that would be ideal for both basketball and hockey. So maybe that's the solution. You get the Coyotes to kind of figure something out with Glendale for 2 or 3 years. The Suns stay where they are for 2 or 3 years. And then somewhere around, I don't know, well, it had to be longer than that because the D-backs will probably be there. They will be there through 2022. And it takes a little time to deconstruct and rebuild. So this is probably something that might be 7 or 8 years out, but it's definitely.
And that would scratch the itch because it would get the Coyotes out of the West Valley and get them back to where they had their most success attendance-wise, I think, when they arrived. And they could build the arena the right way where it would be suitable for basketball and hockey.
Everybody wins out of the deal, including the Suns. So that's something that would bear watching, especially from the county level. I got to get a thought from you too, Eric, and just to kind of go big picture. We have a Game 7 tonight in Stanley Cup playoffs, Winnipeg and Nashville.
Nothing better than Game 7 in the NHL playoffs.
There is a column today, an ESPN writer wrote a column, and he said something I've been saying for quite a while.
Okay.
Is it good or bad for the NHL and for Las Vegas for the Golden Knights to win the Stanley Cup?
No.
I agree. And it's based on two things. Would it hurt the NHL? It'd be a little bit hard to explain how an expansion team, which normally is just cast-offs put together,
and they are, and in many ways, they are cast-offs, and a lot of those cast-offs are having career years.
That's the thing.
But when you have a hot goalie that's been hot pretty much the entire season, you have a chance.
You do.
I mean, they're not a fluke.
It's always been.
They're no joke. I mean, they have a chance to win it all this year.
Well, let's look at Las Vegas for a minute. If that team wins a Stanley Cup, that's great for a first year. But what do you sell your fans in years 2, 3, and 4? There will be an inevitable downturn.
Yep.
the franchise will kind of pull back to the middle, maybe even become an expansion team in terms of performance at one point. Well, what does the fan base do then? Do they stick with them? By that time, the Raiders will have established themselves in Las Vegas. There's every chance the NBA at some point would be in Las Vegas.
Or to flip it around, they may just attract better players there because it is Vegas, because you can win, because it is good living, because the weather is nice. It might be the new landing spot for the mega free agents that want to get out of Canada or want to move west and go to a team that's legit.
I've always said Las Vegas is the new Phoenix in terms of it's now the destination point. 30 years ago,
and that's bad news for us.
Yeah, it is.
Phoenix,
not in terms of teams, but in terms of securing events. There will be a Super Bowl. There's going to be a Final Four
in that
stadium in Vegas,
the
Raiders Stadium. A lot of things that we've been used to having here are going to start going up there.
And they have their sparkling new,
T-Mobile Arena. And there's a lot of things that they'll be able to do. They're going to host a Super Bowl very soon after the Raiders arrive. I don't think there's any question. So I think it'd be very interesting. I do think that it would be good for the NHL if Vegas made the Stanley Cup final, because I think it makes it a huge TV draw. But in terms of winning, I'm not sure that's the best thing in the world for that franchise. Tim Kempton will talk about the pro basketball franchise in Phoenix, its new head coach, and who looks the best to him on the draft board, when we continue on a Thursday on the Brad Sesmatt Show. Back on a Thursday, Brad Sesmatt Show, Jeff Munn for Brad. Always good to talk hoops with my pal Tim Kempton, radio color analyst for the Phoenix Suns, and the man who helped put Miami back at its place when he was at Notre Dame. That's a 30 for 30 reference. I had to get that in. How are you, brother?
I'm good. Money. What's going on?
Not a thing. Hey, have they scheduled that press conference for Igor yet?
You know what? I do not know. I haven't been paying attention. I'm actually moving a kid.
Oh, it's Monday. Eric,
this morning.
Eric told me it's Monday at 9 a.m.
It's Monday?
Yep, Monday morning.
Are you going to be there?
Me?
Yeah.
I don't think I could get in the building. They wouldn't let me in.
I'll take you in.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll meet you down there then. Listen, I like this hire because obviously he has a working knowledge of the organization. And the other thing, and I think this is really important at this particular time, he's a good teacher. He develops players. And that's not to say Jay Triano couldn't or didn't, but if you're going to hire a head coach for a young team, he's got to be able to work with players. And that's what Igor Kokoskov does.
Yeah, I really like to hire. It's not the shiny penny. It's actually the substance hire. And I was really happy to see after they didn't, keep going with Jay Triano, because I thought Jay did a phenomenal job. Igor was my pick. Not that I'm claiming any responsibility for Igor getting hired, of course. But for me, knowing of what I do about Igor and where he's been, what he's done, my conversations with him when he was with the Suns, when he's been with Utah, knowing what he's done over in Europe, I really like the whole part of Igor Kokoshkov, the years being an assistant, a guy that's cut his teeth in Europe as a head coach for the country of Georgia, as well as Slovenia, working with Goran Dragic, working with, Mike D'Antoni, Alvin Gentry, now Quinn Snyder. And the list goes on and on. He just has so much knowledge of the game and so many different aspects to pull from. And then his ability to connect with the young players, I think, is phenomenal.
You know, you just touched on something I think is really important. You mentioned D'Antoni, Alvin Gentry, Quinn Snyder. And we talk a lot of times about the importance of teaching a team or a coach getting hired from winning programs, because young players, they not only have to be taught basketball, they have to be taught how to win in the NBA.
Yes, and another thing I like about that also, and without naming names, is when you're an assistant for one person, one guy, one team for a number of years, you kind of get tunnel vision. All you know is that one guy, the system that you've been in for 6, 7, 8 years. That's what I like about Igor even more, is the number of guys he's worked for. Being able to pull the pluses from everybody and coming up with his own style, his own, kind of recipe. When you tend to stay with one guy, it's kind of just a repetitive knowledge of what you learn from that one person. You don't have other voices kind of challenging that one system. So that's another reason I like Igor so much, is he's worked with so many guys. He's had the ability to take the best and also have discussions with other people, because when you're working with one guy, you're talking about another guy's system, and why it's good, why it's not good. So I think Igor is very, very well-rounded in offensive and defensive concepts because of all the guys that he's worked under.
Tim Kempton, Suns radio analyst, joining us for a few moments on the Brett Sesmatch Show. All right, let's look at the draft. The lottery's next Tuesday. I'm looking at a mock draft, and there's a million of them out there, but this is from NBADraft.net, and they're just going on the records rather than trying to do their own lottery. And they've got the Suns at the number one pick, and they've got them taking DeAndre Ayton. Now, I know with Kokoskov's hire, a lot of people are talking about, I believe it's, I want to say it right, Luka Dencic out of Slovenia.
Luka Doncic.
Doncic. Boy, it's a good thing I don't broadcast basketball, because I mess up names all the time. Anyway, I said this to Al. I did the show the day after you guys wrapped up at Dallas, and I had Al on. And you know, Tim, I work with a coach during the winter. She would rather binge watch Gilligan's Island than get out-rebounded in a game. So I said to Al, I said, isn't there still a premium on big men in this game? Because, the current mode in the NBA is bombs away. Shoot, get as many shots off from outside as you can. But there still has to be somebody there to clean up the glass. And that's why I think whether they draft 1, 2, 3, whatever, you got to look big man.
Yeah, I think so. And also with the probable Alex Len not re-signing. The Suns didn't see much value in Alex. If anybody has listened to the broadcast over the last couple of years, and you and I have talked about this, I love Alex Len. I think he is going to do very well moving on. But it also kind of forces the Suns' hand to go get a big, because if Alex is not here, then we have Tyson Chandler and Alan Williams. We know Tyson Chandler's on his last year of his contract, and then Alan Williams is not someone that's going to protect the middle, that's going to go and get those rebounds that you need in today's day and age. So I think the Suns have kind of, with that number one pick, they almost have to go for DeAndre Ayton, because it fits a need, but it also probably the best player on the board with that number one pick.
Yeah, I saw him a couple of times. I don't get to see a lot of men's basketball as much as I'd like, for obvious reasons, because I'm off with the other teams traveling and I don't get in front of the TV. But when I've seen Ayton, he looks like a man amongst boys, and that is in the college ranks. He'll be a little different in the NBA, but he still looks like he's got the whole package.
Exactly. And then we talk about the development. I mean, you look at how Rudy Gobert has come along while Igor has been part of the process of Rudy Gobert getting better with the Utah Jazz. Everything points to me, at least from a need and from the timeline prospects and what the Suns could use and the best player on the ball on the board, it would be DeAndre Ayton.
All right, I want to, and Tim Kempton joins us here on the Brad Sesmatch Show. I want to get a thought from you about where the franchise is. And you just hit on something I think is really important. In hiring Igor Kokoskov, you're right. They didn't hire the big, sexy name or the guy all the fans might have all wanted. But they made a smart basketball decision. And that always signals to me in a case like that with a franchise that's trying to build, that when you start making the smart decisions, that's when you really start getting out of the doldrums and start trending upward.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Like I said, you know, and then there were a couple of sexy names that was being bantered around. You know, Mike Budenholzer, and but I do. I think Igor is more substance, and as you said, I think it's a great basketball decision. Now the next one is the pick. You know, what's the best pick there when it comes down to that? We'll find out Tuesday what number we get, but exactly, you know, obviously the Devin Booker kind of got a little lucky with him because he's the 13th pick, but I think Josh Jackson is kind of rounding in to what we expected of him, a guy that, you know, very complimentary to Devin Booker. I don't think people realized how good offensively he is, but, you know, that defender that plays with a chip on his shoulder, aggressive, long athlete. We saw what T.J. Warren can do. You don't even have to call his number. You know, he's going to get offensive rebounds. He's going to run in transition. He's going to play kind of in that no man's land. But I like it because, you know, Jeff, it's almost like people don't even think to defend that mid-range game anymore because so many people are geared toward, oh, it's either a layup or it's a three-pointer. And T.J. Warren does such a phenomenal job in that mid-range area.
Yep.
So I like the balance of having T.J. there of, well, if he's scoring at a high efficient rate at that mid-range game, now you have three areas. You know, you almost don't have to play it when you play the Houston Rockets and some of these other teams that have obviously come out and said, oops, we're either getting a layup or a three-pointer, and you're mocked if you take a mid-range game. I still like that. So, yeah, the pieces are there. Now the next one is to find that hole in the middle because Alex Len isn't coming back, and there's a guy right there that everybody thinks can be that next piece that would be the smart basketball move to go along with the need in DeAndre Ayton.
I got about a minute. Let's talk playoffs very quickly. The conference finals are set. We get the matchup in the West everybody wanted, Houston and Golden State. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of attention on Cleveland and Boston. Let's start with the East very quickly. If LeBron and the Cavs win this series, in my mind, now he moves ahead of Jordan because Jordan, for all those years, he did win more titles than LeBron, but he had a whole lot more to work with in terms of talent. LeBron is carrying the Cavs right now on his back totally.
Yeah, he is. And the way I look at it, I'm not going to – they're two of the greatest – they're two of the top five greatest basketball players ever to walk the face of the planet. I'm not going 1A, 1B. Jordan's better. You know, different time, different games, different sets of rules, different lineups. It's really hard to quantify – you know, one versus the other. I just know that they're both great basketball players and dominate in the game that they play at the level. Having said that, going back to what you just said, Money, I think Boston is too well-rounded for LeBron to be able to beat them solely by himself. I don't think the rest of his lineup is enough for them to make it to the NBA championships. I'm sorry.
In the West, everybody will talk about all the offensive firepower on both teams. So let me turn it around. Who's the better defensive team, Houston or Golden State?
I think Golden State is just because they do it better. They've been doing it a little bit longer, and I like their mental toughness a little bit better. You know, they just seem to play together, and they're not worried at the ball movement of the Golden State Warriors, I think, makes it tougher to defend. And Houston still isolates a little bit too much for me with Chris Paul and James Harden. I think you can play a little bit better there. But I think it's the mental edge for Golden State that gets over in this series. So if you're going to force me, I'm going to say Golden State and Boston in the NBA championship.
You know, we know both. I don't know Mike D'Antoni as well as you do, but I've met him, and you know, terrific guy. You think he's feeling any pressure in this because this is probably the best shot he'll ever have at getting to a finals?
I don't think there's any outward pressure. There's more, you know, there's more internal pressure from himself of what he's trying to accomplish. I don't think Mike really, you know, I mean, you know, Jeff, the athlete, the coach, they put way more pressure on themselves than any press or media guy could ever do. So I don't think he's playing into the pressure of, you know, he's absolutely has to win it now. I mean, he's going against the Golden State Warriors. They're a great team. He's done a phenomenal job with Houston, putting pieces together with Daryl Morey, putting a team out there that's fun to watch, taking advantage of the way the rules are in today's game. So I think he's pretty happy and content with that. If he wins a championship, great. But he's got more internal pressure than anything that media could put on him.
I would agree with you, and it's a fascinating subject to discuss, and we're going to have to do it another time because we're out of time right now.
We'd love to.
TK, good to see you, pal, or good to hear from you. If I can get over there Monday morning, I'll find you, and you can sneak me into the press conference.
All right, and how about NAU with back-to-back national championships with their cross-country team?
How about it?
Not bad for the little school up the hill.
Not bad at all, and it's tough to be good at cross country at that elevation too. You got to be something special to be dominant.
Special up here.
You're not kidding. Hey, good to talk to you, Tim. Stay safe.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
You got it, Tim Kempton, Suns color radio radio color analyst, joining us for a few moments on the Brett Sesmat Show. Lottery's next Tuesday. It'll be really interesting to see what happens after everything falls out. Kurt Warner. I had a different reaction than maybe a lot of people when I heard the news about Kurt Warner this week, and I'll discuss it coming up. This is the Brad Sesmat Show. We come to you through Sports360AZ.com and AZCentralSports.com. Back on a Thursday on the Brad Sesmat Show, I don't know if you can see this. I got to move in position. I'm wearing a shirt today from the Hard Rock Golf Club in Cancun. ASU women's basketball was there over Thanksgiving. Eric Sorensen, you're into that rock and roll music, aren't you? You're a rock and roll aficionado?
Yeah, I'm into it.
Okay, the Hard Rock Resort in Cancun.
I want to go, like, now.
Yeah,
can we leave immediately?
You got to go to it because it's phenomenal.
Or anywhere in Cancun?
All-inclusive. You get a wristband. Off you go. You don't pay for anything.
Oh.
Including the golf. And at the golf course, which is like 5 miles from the actual resort, they have to drive you by shuttle.
Right.
Okay, it's a Hard Rock and roll theme. All the golf holes are named after the title of a classic rock tune. So you get to the third hole. It's a par three with a lot of sand traps. What would that hole be called?
It's got to be Inner Sandman,
right?
It
is. You're exactly right.
Wow, I'm so smart.
Oh, I love the course. The course is it's challenging, but to a guy like me that I'm like, I can't hit it very far, it's still a lot of fun to play, and we had a great time, but I just had to get that in. The story about Kurt Warner, apparently, and I believe he said it during a St. Louis Cardinals baseball telecast that, he would have been in St. Louis for something connected to his days with the St. Louis Rams, of course. But he said, apparently on that telecast, that he had contacted NFL teams about coming out of retirement last year, and he still thinks he could play now. Now, he's 47, I believe, either 47 or 48 years of age. And I read further, he was on a local radio station this week saying that if he was going to come back and play, he would not accept a deal with a team to be a backup. He'd have to be a starter. And so, okay, let me preface this by saying I do not know the man personally. I've met him once. My contact with him was actually when he was a quarterback with the Iowa Barnstormers of Arena Football. They came in 1995, beat the Rattlers in a playoff game that was a heartbreaker, and then the Rattlers won the Arena Bowl from them 2 years later. There's no question the man is to be respected and well-regarded, not only because of his football accomplishments, he's in the Hall of Fame, but as a Catholic, I admire the fact that he's a Christian and professes his faith. He not only talks the talk, he walks the walk, does a lot of great stuff in the community for charity. But this story about him thinking that he could come back and play at 48 and tell a team, I'm going to be a starter, just sounds to me like a guy. It's Brett Favre-like. We all kind of giggle at Brett Favre when he just simply would not let go. He kept looking for teams to sign with the Jets, then the Vikings. And everybody said, when is he going to get it through his head that it's over? And when I see things like that, I hate to say this, but that's the first thing that popped into my mind, is that Kurt Warner's having trouble accepting the fact that he's had to take the pads and the helmet off. He hadn't played in a game since 2009. If you remember, the main reason he got out, I believe Brenda was the one that was really pushing him to get out, because he had suffered a concussion, had a couple of injuries, and that was 9 years ago. He's 9 years older. I just cannot conceive how he would really think that he could come back and, A, start. And you know how these guys think. He's not going to go to the Cleveland Browns, who have very little shot at winning. He wants to play for a team that would have a shot at a Super Bowl. Well, you think about it for a minute. Think of all the real legitimate contenders in the NFL. Do they need a starting quarterback? And if they needed one, would they call Kurt Warner? And I look, I'm going to say this, and if you're a Kurt Warner fan and you're offended by this, I'm sorry, but this smacks of he's being Brett Favre. He can't let go. And as far as this, you know, what he did this week, okay, you got to do it once. You got to say, I want to come back once. Don't do it again. Because then you become the boy that cries wolf. You got the media all excited. You got every local sports outlet in town crawling the walls when you said it. And it's fine. It's a story. You have to cover it. But if you do it a second time, people are going to see through it, Kurt. Your legacy will get tarnished. You'll turn from a Hall of Famer to a punchline. Don't do it. You've had a great career. You're in the Hall of Fame. I know that, I guess, your NFL Network deal's expiring. Come on, you don't think that you couldn't find another TV job like that? You'd be great in a booth. ESPN made a terrible mistake not putting you on Monday Night Football. Joe Tessitore and Jason Witten will be the worst pairing in the history of that package. The worst ever. They made a terrible mistake not putting you in that booth. But you'll find another gig. Don't do this again. It's over. Accept the fact that it's over. And don't let your legacy get tarnished by this. Please, don't do it again. Bill Gutekunst has a few things to say about movies that are coming out this weekend. And boy, we're going all over the map this weekend. And we'll talk about it right after this on the Brad Sesmatt Show. It's Thursday, and that means a chance to get caught up on what's going on at the movies. As Brad likes to say, you got to have a life outside sports. So we check in, as we do each Thursday, with AZ Central Gannett Chief Film and Media Critic Bill Gutekunst. We got three films to get to. We got any time at the end. I've got a little bit of my famous Stump Goody trivia for you, Bill. But let's start with the movies first. And we're going in a lot of different directions with the three films this week. Let's start with Revenge. I want you to talk about it, and then I'm going to give you a thought that came to my mind as I'm watching the trailer. But just give me an overview of this movie first.
It's really good. It's very stylish. A woman directed it and wrote it, and it's basically a revenge film, as you might guess from the title. Really stylish, like almost hyper stylized. A lot of color. It's sort of out in the desert, but it is brutal. I mean, there's no way around it. It is super violent and almost supernaturally so. Like, this stuff happens to this woman that's just unbelievably bad, and she manages not to. She's bruised and battered, but not quite broken. But that said, it's good.
Yeah, it's, and I'm watching this, and the trailer, I think, that's about as graphic a trailer as I've ever seen. But I had this thought at the end of it, Bill. Given the current climate, the Me Too movement, the sense of empowerment that women are now having, rightly so, I wonder if a movie like this will pick up some momentum from that. If there's any, it's hard to connect, because this is about revenge for an attempt at murder. But still, I think that it gives you I can see where there would be some people that would go see it just because of the current political climate.
Oh, I think so. And I think the fact that, I mean, yes, it empowers the woman. It sort of turns the gory horror movie on its ear. You know, I mean, she is at first the hunted, and then she becomes the hunter, you know. But it's also, I think, that is compounded and made somewhat stronger by the fact that a woman wrote and directed it. So it's not necessarily from, you know, there's no way around it. And that's one of the things with the Me Too movement is a lot of it has to do with point of view. And, you know, stories told from a man's point of view, a man trying to tell a woman's story. And this is not that. So I think you're right. Yeah, I think it will.
Now, a real change of gears as we talk about Melissa McCarthy's latest movie, Life of the Party. Okay, so at the beginning of the trailer, I thought to myself, oh, it's just a female version of Back to School, the old Rodney Dangerfield film. But it does approach it from a little different angle, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's not any good. There's that angle. The Rodney Dangerfield movie wasn't exactly Citizen Kane, but it was. It had some funny moments. This actually has some funny moments, too. Melissa McCarthy is hilarious. But she's funny when she's being mean. She is like a master of the put-down. There's this, if you see the movie This Is 40, at the end of it, there are outtakes, and you can find them on YouTube, where she and Paul Rudd and Leslie Mann are sitting there, and in the movie she's supposed to take them down and say bad stuff about them. And what they did was they let them improv, and she just goes and goes and goes and goes and goes and goes, and it is side splitting. But what I think she needs is a good director and a good editor. She and her husband Ben Falcone wrote this, and he directed it. He's directed her in a few things. He tends not to direct her very well. I mean, they tried to be sweet and smarmy and stuff. The funniest stuff in this movie is when she is clearly ad-libbing and just, you know, goes off on people. And it's in sort of a sweeter way in this movie, but that's the best part. But otherwise, it's just, ugh, no good.
Just a quick thought. Is she the female Will Ferrell? Because I've always thought Will Ferrell is a guy that he's like a one-pitch pitcher. He can do it one way. He does variations on it. But it just comes back to the same guy over and over and over.
Well, and much like the one pitch pitcher, when they're on, they're unhittable, and when they're not, they're worthless. I mean, they don't do your team any good. Yeah, I think that's a pretty good parallel because they're both funny, and I think that, but like most people in life, myself included, they need an editor.
Well, we all do at times. the third film, Measure of a Man. I could tell from the trailer what the movie is about, but I was sitting there saying
to
myself, somewhat. I mean, it's a story about a young man who's a little overweight and he gets bullied, and it's a coming of age movie, I think. And I guess that's the point. I'm watching the trailer and I'm thinking, is this enough to get me to go to the theater? And I thought, no.
your instincts are good. It's a movie that you've seen a million times before, done better. And the interesting thing about it, Robert Lipsyte, the sports columnist who has written a lot of books, it's based on a book that he wrote a long time ago called One Fat Summer. And I guess they can't really say fat anymore, you know, so they've changed that. And it's Donald Sutherland's in it. That's kind of cool. It's kind of cool at this point just to hear him talk.
Yeah.
But it's everything in it is you can. It's like I think in my review I said that he goes to summer at Lake Obvious and his dad wants him to work at Camp Cliche or whatever. You know, it's like everything about it is predictable and none of it other than occasionally Sutherland and even him they don't really handle right. I'll tell you what it is. It's one of those fake good movies. It kind of looks good and it pretends to be important and stuff, but if you're not careful, it can trick you into going to see it. But I would say you can pass on it.
You mentioned Donald Sutherland, and it always makes me think of my kids grew up laughing at the TV series MASH. They have never seen the movie. And I always think to myself, if there's somebody like that who's all they know of MASH is the TV series, the movie would leave them with their jaw hitting the floor. Not because it's bad. It's a terrific movie. But the portrayal that Donald Sutherland has of Hawkeye is about as far removed from Alan Alda as you can imagine.
Yes, it's unrecognizable. It's good. As you say, I mean, it's a great movie. And Robert Altman made a lot of great movies. But you almost have to think of it as separate from the TV show. I mean, they were doing different things, particularly at the end of the TV show. You know, the beginning.
It became an anti-war statement type show. And not that the movie wasn't. There's tinges of it, but it was more dark humor than the TV series ever was. The people who do the TV series always say the episode, Sometimes You Hear the Bullet, was the turning point for that show. It made it a hit, gave it a message to deliver. All right, I got to do this.
I can tell you, but I have to tell you quickly. I can quote from that episode. All I know is what they taught me in command school. And rule number one is, in war, young men die. Rule number two is, doctors can't change rule number one.
And you're right. I remember that line very well. McLean Stevenson, who made a...
My hero, Henry Blake.
Henry Blake, who made a... And McLean Stevenson, God rest his soul, terrible career decision to leave that show. But we never would have gotten Harry Morgan saying things like, mule fritters! Anyway, I got to get this in. This is not a TV trivia. This time I've gone movies. I'm sure you and I both share a love of the movie Caddyshack. Right? You're a big fan of Caddyshack.
Yes, I love it.
And, okay, real quick, who's your favorite Caddyshack character?
Oh, man, it changes like any good movie. When Bill Murray's in there, he's great, but he's hardly in it at all. Rodney Dangerfield is so good. I actually kind of like the main guy, the caddy.
Michael O'Keefe.
He was about 30 when he made it, but he looks young. But I like him a lot. I like the kind of way that he sort of takes things as they come.
You know?
I don't know.
Now, you mentioned Dangerfield. He played Al Chervik, the boorish contractor who, it's a country club of snobs, and he's the slob. I saw an interview over the weekend, it was on YouTube, with the late Harold Ramis, who wrote and directed the movie. And he said that when he and his fellow writers sat down to develop the script, not really just write it out word for word, but develop it, they had this character in mind, and originally... they had another stand-up comic in mind who had done movies to play the role of Al Chervik.
Shoot. I'm trying to think of the age, because he probably would have been younger than Dangerfield.
I can give you a little two-word hint. Hockey puck.
Don Rickles.
They had originally thought this would be perfect for Don Rickles. And then Ramis says in the interview, as they were writing out the script, they kind of looked at each other and said, you know what, this would be better for Rodney Dangerfield. And they were a little reluctant because they weren't sure Dangerfield had ever acted in a movie before. He hadn't. But they signed him.
And they had trouble with that.
Well, to a couple of things. And the greatest story was the first time he shot a scene where he's just, and they let him ad lib a bunch of stuff. The first time he did it, they get done with the scene. He goes over to Scott Colomby, who is kind of Michael O'Keefe's antagonist in the movie. And he goes over to Colomby and says, I'm dying. I'm bombing. Nobody's laughing. And Colomby had to explain to him, no, Rodney, they can't laugh because if they do, we can't use the sound. And that's that. Apparently, several people have told that story, so it must be true. But I saw that.
I think it is.
Yeah, and it's, you know.
There's a great new book about the making of Caddyshack. You should check it out.
I heard about that, and I am going to check it out. Sundance ran the movie over the weekend. That's what got me to thinking about it. Sunday night, they ran back-to-back. They ran Blazing Saddles, Caddyshack, and which other one did they do? Back to School. And I just thought, that was Nirvana. Back to School, by the way, I'll just go out on this, should be shown on some channel every Father's Day. That's the best Father's Day movie ever made. Hey, Goody, appreciate it. Have a good weekend. We'll talk to you next week.
All righty.
Bill Goody Koontz, you got it. Bill Goody Koontz, AZ Central and Gannett Chief Film and Media Critic. It is the weekend coming up, so... hopefully you've got some good plans, too. Movies? Yeah, why not? Get in out of the heat. And be sure to stay with us here at sports360az.com. We'll have all your weekend sports info all throughout the weekend. And, of course, you can always catch back up right here on the Brad Sesmatch Show.